Uvula Audio presents Frederick R. Ewing's I, Libertine. Copyright 1956, Ballantine Books, Inc. Performed by James Campanella. Chapter 1. It had been a bright foregathering. Bright people with their bright talk suffusing him with the warm radiance of his own bright future. Captain Lance Courtney was proud of himself. He had watched his own words all evening, falling as ordered and as startling as the brocade on his fashionable waistcoat. He felt his presence in such company was as timely and as casual as the stylish solitaire around his neck. Aye, bright was the word, and the next, and the one after, would be brilliant. Captain Courtney was on his way.
"Not on your way so soon?"
asked Lady Blanton, as he bent over her wrinkled hand. And again he was pleased, for his ear was quick, and he knew the overtones of sincerity when they appeared in a common phrase.
"I leave part of myself with you, my lady," he said.
He knew a way to produce his words with a breath like sighing, and a firm rumble deep in his chest, a whisper with a contrabass.
"You know I remain here in spirit, and a decent bit of my heart is yours alone."
"Along with you, rascal,"
she said. But she fluttered. She twinkled. She had been reached.
"You'd only eyes for Miss Axelrood the whole evening."
This was true, but he shook his head and smiled. His teeth were excellent, especially the right upper incisor, which was extraordinary.
"As we say in Devon, who studies a sheep to steal had better know the shepherdess."
The old lady laughed heartily, then drew him a step into the foyer.
"I think, to this day, I've heard Libby Chadley called everything but a shepherdess."
Sobering, she leaned close and said almost anxiously,
"Tell me, Captain, as a young man correct in all things, do you think it quite, well, proper of me to entertain her, even when she brings such an ornament as her little Miss Axelrood?"
He contemplated her question and her earrings. Her earrings were diamond clusters, probably Italian, and glorified Mammon more than the Muses. He was delighted with them, and with their owner, who prompted him.
"Have I embarrassed you, young man?"
"You have gratified me, milady. As to your question, I feel that your house is the heart of Holborn, Holborn the heart of London, and London the heart of the world. If, then, all things are in the world, do not all things have a place here?"
"You have not answered my question, and you have been charming," said Lady Blanton approvingly. "Tell me this, too. Do you always call for your carriage at the very peak of an evening?"
"My carriage called for me,"
he rejoined. At the same time he managed to raise and hold his hat in a way which might have had significance. At any rate, she glanced at it. It was a wide-brimmed hat of the usual mode, drawn up and pinned three-corner style.
"Ah," she said, "you military men, with your mysterious comings and goings. Well, may I reach you, Captain?"
Behind the warmth and sincerity of his smile, a small explosion of exasperation threatened. That again. Always that. What gleaming boots and good broadcloth could accomplish, the lack of an address could sweep away. With England weighted to sinking with town houses and granges, castles and manors, he had none to claim, even as resident, even as visitor. He said,
"I cannot say, my lady. I await orders. They come tomorrow at the latest. If one might have the privilege of writing..."
"You may call it a duty. Good night, young man."
"Milady..."
He kissed her hand again and strode quickly through the door, which stood open to the warm spring night, too quickly for a sight of the servant's outstretched palm. Down the steps he sprang and into his carriage, which stood all agleam in a fair yellow paint and dull red trim, a match to the small crest of the Courtenays on the quarter panel. The coachman gathered his lines and grumbled in a resounding basso,
"Aye, me peacock! Another instant of that chitty-chatty, and ye'd ha' ridden astride your own ass!"
"Hush, you old fool!" snapped the captain, and then, "Hold! Halt!" as the wet grey entrance brought forth a vision. Down the steps came the fair Miss Axelrood, little feet a-twinkle, and her hoops held high. She leaped to the carriage step, alighting like a bird, her eyes and teeth sparkling in the glow from Blanton House. Lance Courtney impulsively caught at her bare shoulder to steady her, and she turned it under his hand and away, laughing. He had to control the impulse to look down into his hand. Such warmth and smoothness seemed to cling there.
"You have at last been ungallant, Captain Courtney, and all evening I had been sure you could not be."
"I assure you, Miss Axel—"
"A gentleman," she chided, "is never inadvertently impolite."
Before he could rephrase this toward understanding, she gave him that small, dazzling laugh again and explained,
"You left me, and bade me no adieu."
"A thousand pardons," he whispered,
the hiss with the viol.
"I leave against my will, a sudden and most urgent—"
"I don't want your apologies, Captain Courtney, and I'll allow all your explanations. I have flown out here, bold as can be, only for your farewell."
"Au revoir,"
he hazarded.
"Ah, just that. I know we shall meet again."
"It could not be too soon."
"It could. It shall be."
And she sprang away to the steps and up them, turning to laugh again just as she disappeared.
"Now there's a saucy bit," rumbled the coachman, "and one to beware of, Lanky."
"Drive, dash it all, Pigot."
"Hager, Pigot,"
said the man good-naturedly, leaning heavily on the aspirant.
"Don't take away my respectable hyphen."
He flicked his lines, and the coach rumbled into Gray's Inn Road. Lance Courtney waited until they were safely out of earshot of Blanton House and the traffic around it, and then flared.
"Damn! I'll take away more than your blasted hyphen if you don't stop making a fool of me in front of your betters."
"Eh?"
shrugged the coachman.
"Ye come by it honest, Lanky. We're all fools. Who is that pretty baggage, anyhow?"
Fuming, Lance ignored the question. Through Oxford Street he ignored it, through the river corner of Cheapside, but at the bridge he surprised himself by answering,
"She's a Miss Axelrood."
The coachman said nothing. Lolloping down between the bridge shops, the coach was half across the river before Lance amended, "She was brought by Miss Chudley." This got a response. Pigot hummed with interest.
"Was she, then? How long has the old whore been back in England?"
"I don't know. Not long." He was always reluctant somehow to discuss anything with a foul-mouthed old man, yet Pigot was in a position to pick up an encyclopedic amount of gossip. He said challengingly,
"She's a splendid-looking woman, though I only got a glimpse of her. She's not old, Pigot."
"She's seen her 20 and half another one by now. Why, she was your age when she went naked to the Venetian ambassador's ball, and that was 25 years ago at the least."
"Not naked, Pigot."
"Aye, naked. And do you think they pitched her into the Serpentine for that? No, his admiring majesty, the second George, gave her a 50-guinea watch. Greedy bitch. Do you know she's wed to the Earl of Bristol's brother?"
"I don't know that. I had heard it," said Lance primly.
"She is, for all that. Could have had the Earl of Bath. and struck the Duke of Hamilton twixt wind and water, taking a piece along like a cannon ball off an oaken frigate. Maid of honour at court she was. Eh, I could tell you what she was made of, but 'twas Bristol's brother she wanted, and Bristol's brother she got one midnight. Then off she goes to the sea. Whelped one for him too, or so they say.
Whatever became of the child? Pickett shrugged wide old shoulders.
Dead by now, or given away. Growing up somewhere like the rest of us, believing what he's told, whether it's true or not. He might have been the first the bitch dropped by the wayside, or he might not. I can tell you, he weren't the last, and mayhap the last hasn't passed those portals even now. Old Lib's seen to it.
Pigot, you've a filthy mouth.
Aye, it's a filthy time.
Lance looked out over the black water and denied this with all his being. Long association with Pigot made this denial a silent one, but none the less firmament for that. There was right, and there was wrong. Though these may not immediately present themselves to a man, he'd need only dig a little deeper, wait a little longer to find them out. The dirty grey world in which Pigot lived filled him with horror, drove him constantly toward the white purities of a gentleman's existence. Yet the fact remained that grey was made up of particles of white in the blackness, and Pigot presented him with many of these. "What do you mean?" she still added.
"What do you talk about in yon cold frame of a house, you and the other winter blooms?"
Pigot blazed. "Whatever it is, it isn't hostler's gossip."
"And a pity it is."
Pigot aimed his whip-handle at the young man's broadcloth.
"England and Prussia rule the ruddy world this anno ruddy domino 1769,
he orated.
"And those that rule the world take the orders of their ostlers, aye, their valets, and their maids of ruddy honour. They do what they're told they do, because their servants always know what's happening, and they can't know till they're told, like a ruddy great general wanting to know what's happening over the hill. He can ask his batman, and likely he does. Otherwise, it's someone else's batman who finds out. Or it's as old to go all the way down the line to a weary-ass grenadier who finally sticks his head over and eats grape-shot for his breakfast. And who's more of a servant than anybody's ruddy foot-soldier, I'd like to know? While you're about learning your airs and graces, me lad, never forget to leave an ear in the scullery, and be grateful to whoever keeps the wax out of it for you. What were we talking about?"
"You were making some libelous remarks about Miss Chudley."
"Nay, lad, 'twas slander,"
the old man corrected. In the darkness, Lance Courtney blushed. There were reasons why the distinction should have been his to make. Pigot went on.
"My Lord Augustus Hervey, the Duke of Bristol's brother, has so many horns on him from our lib, 'tis said without a wig he looks like a ruddy all-tree. And when she hasn't been hawking her wares to foreigners on some of their own grounds, she's been the oar of the Duke of Kingston, old Evie Pierpont."
"Look," said Lance, too enthralled at this point to affect disdain, "if she really is Hervey's wife, why has she kept it a secret all these years?"
"Had to, when he slipped the ring on her hand, and he wasn't of age. Afraid he wouldn't inherit if it got about. And so was she. By the time he did come in for his small slice, she was already abed with Kingston and wanted no mite nor morsel of her husband. He's a queer duck anyhow, Bristol is. Happy with his ships and his grouse. And with her too, long as she keeps her hooks out of the Bristol treasury. And that she does, with Kingston there to cover her nakedness when he ain't using it, and giving her bits of townhouses to keep the rain off."
"That can't last long."
"Aye, we all get older."
"What do you mean by that?"
"It's been going on these 24 years, lad, since before you were born."
"I can't believe that. Why doesn't he divorce her?"
Pigott's burst of laughter startled the off-horse. When he had her reined in, he said,
Scandal, lad.
Isn't this all scandal?
Nay, it's what you call ostler's gossip. Fine folk can stand any amount of that now. But bring in your courts, and your swear-ins, and defaults, and it's scandals, and it hurts 'em. Bristol's not like England and Frederick the Ruddy Great these days. Fight a war for 7 years, and settle it with everybody home, where they come from. What they call status quo ante, only the poor for it. Kingston's getting what he's paying for, or thinks he is, or he wouldn't be paying for it. And Libby Chudley's got enough of the Kingston entrails wrapped around her finger to make a duchess of her, weren't it for Hervey. She'll drop him when he stands to inherit, and she'll not drop Kingston either. They all take their pleasures, lad, and the only real cost is Ostler's gossip.
I'm glad such people have your approval, said Lance, regaining his loftiness.
You're a smarmy little prig, said Pigott reflectively.
We're coming into Southwark, said Lance. We'd better...
Aye,
said the coachman, pulling left to the curb. He lashed up the reins and plunged his arms down into the boot. From it he drew a folded cloak, which he handed down to Lance, receiving the captain's good woolen for it. Lance threw on the second cloak, removed his tricorn, unpinned the ribbons, and let the brim drop down. Pigott swung down and stepped to the right quarter panel, where after a moment he emerged with the crest of the Courtenays. Three red roundels on a golden field. This he placed on the seat beside Lance. He went around to the left side and turned the air blue with his imprecations.
"Some pile-ridden catamites bit at me, coach," he roared. 4 shillings, 6 3/4 up the spout, or half of it. And God blind you if you get another lanky."
Lance leaned close and looked. Pigott was pounding the dangling straps from which the second Courtenay crest had been unbuckled. What happened to it?
What happened to the bloody holy grail? I don't know. Damn blast the pox-pucked mother of the fatherless colonial who did this.
You're losing sight with your wits in your old age, said Lance. Next they'll have the wheels while you sit on the box a-gossip with some other old swine.
By God, we've crossed the river. It's your turn to keep a civil tongue in your head, you little wart.
This bargain is beginning to be over costly to me, said the young man icily.
Then strike a bargain with some other hackney. There's upwards of 500 on the streets today. A good third cast off privates like this. Among so many, surely to God, you can find a fool like me. But by my dangling neck, it must be a greater one.
The more fool I, returned Lance. You would be back in the stables, standing in muck, whilst the other hostlers curried your face, taking it for the hind end of a spavent mare, weren't it for me. Who found you this trap? Who paid to dress and paint it? Who flogged you into a decent livery and taught you to blow your nose on your sleeve instead of snapping it in your lap? Who but me?
Ye found the coach, I'll grant you, but who paid for it? Ye bought the paint, who laid it on? Ye prettied me up alongside the trap, and I'll grant a quality fare, say, twice a fortnight for that. But who gives up a hackney money masquerading as a popinjay's pimp? Aye, and stands for your eye and mighty insults all the while.
Reverting to the cadences of a Courtney, and with an imperious gesture, Lance said,
"We have arrived at the dissolution of our partnership, Higger Pigott. You may drive me to my inn. Thereafter you may find your own perdition."
Even in the dark, Lance could see the black, furious flush crossing the old man's face. His voice was thick with anger as he snapped his whip out of the brace, set foot on the step. The carriage leaned and creaked with his weight. He loomed over the young man like a breaking sea. He sprayed and spat as he growled,
aye, sir, that I will, sir, drive you to your inn, and on the instant, but I faithfully promise you, God rot me, that I shall tie up these ruddy horses here and now, and do my driving with this cat."
And he whistled the lash close to the crown of Lance's newly slouched hat. Now it has been recorded that all of this young man's teeth were beautiful,
but that one of them was extraordinary. It was the right upper incisor, and its uniqueness lay in a subtle concavity, from gum to bite and from edge to edge, so finely wrought by nature's lapidary that its difference from the other teeth was invisible on the closest inspection. And like most other wonders created by man or God, this one was meaningless out of its context. Its context was, of course, the man himself, specifically the musculature of his upper lip, and generally his emotional makeup. The latter reacted in all its complexities, most extremely under the impact of terror. The numbness in the back of the knees, the palpitation which struck at the base of the throat like a heavy fist, the aching hollowness in the solar plexus need not concern us here. The drying of the mouth, occurring instantly and completely, however, does, for this resulted in an adhesion of the concave tooth to the inside of the upper lip, an utterly unbearable sensation. Simultaneously, the lips expanded as the cheeks contracted, increasing the hardness of the vacuum which married flesh to enamel. The net result was a spasmodic smile, so tight over the teeth and very wide, a narrowing of the eyes so sudden that, though they held only squeezed tears, they glittered like polished steel, and directly over the tooth, just to the right of the median line, a slight, unceasing movement, as the imprisoned lip fought to free itself from the vice of a vacuum. It was not a twitch, but rather a writhe, a ripple. Such a movement may be seen on the lips of the great cats, just as they are about to attack. Such a shift of the lip might result in a sneer, if allowed to complete one. This, however, did not. The combined forces of smile and suction contained it too well for that. Men who sneer at their potential attackers may cow a few, but are more often attacked. Men who smile in the face of danger are more rare, and are less often attacked. Men whose sneer is there to be seen, and all but eclipsed in a smile, send a message of such confidence that the enemy must turn into himself, find himself face to face with the fear of inferiority which lurks, to some degree, in every man, and, with shocked eyes, filled with this, will ask himself in a frightened wonderment, "How did he know?" A more intimate question cannot be framed. A more vital one may not be imagined. In that instant the urge to attack is replaced by something greater, the desire to have that question answered, and whatever his urgency, whatever his reason, whomever else he might ever attack, this one man is safe from him, especially because he will never answer. So it was that the great grizzled coachman hung over the youth who smiled up at him, and when Lance, in purest terror, began to rise, and because of the confines of the carriage, brought this towering enigma of expression closer and closer to his enemy of the moment, Piggott's rage dissolved into another thing, which ran saltily down his cheek. He stepped back to the curb.
"Aye!"
he grunted, features all a pucker, and hands fumbling with his forgotten whip.
"We have no quarrel, thee and me, lad. I'll not deny I need thee more than thou needest me. And one day thee'll fly up and away, and leave me forgotten in this mud I dwell in."
He swallowed hard, and from the way his features wrung, one might think it burst something in his throat. Then, in a rumble more normal for him, he said,
"I curse ye, Lanky, myself, and sometimes God, that this should be so, but—"
he raised his heavy hands and let them fall.
"It is so."
He climbed up on the box while Lance sank weakly back, shaken to the marrow as he always was by this sequence. It had happened many times before, and always it looked like the end of the world, and then like a swirling faint, and then like a miracle, wherein he emerged from the shameful paralysis to be held as a victor. He was well loved for it, too, always unbelieving, utterly incognizant of the forces he had displayed, even in facsimile. He would wear his laurels gently, treating his defeated enemy with a residual fear which looked exactly like humility and compassion.
"Perhaps you're right,"
he said as the coachman drummed on the cobbles of the Borough High Street.
At times I do go on like a smarmy little prig.
Nay, said the old man, and I'll thank ye not to talk so about yourself. I might again too, but I've a right to be ill-mannered, being what I am.
I shall always be myself this side of the river, said Lance contritely.
This'll not be your side for long,
growled the coachman, scowling at the filth and squalor, the clutter and clabber of these late silent streets. Even deserted, they seemed to ring with the press which had abandoned them, and which would tumble out in the morning, stinking of its sweat and pots and poverty.
Look ye, fold your cloak over your mouth, lad. I swear this city's not fit for a gentleman to breathe in. Ye can get the bloody pox from a gulp of it. Here's Long Lane now, and we'll have Bermondsey and be home directly.
I'll get us a new crest, Piggott.
Nay, ye've a look about you that can't be covered by a slouch hat and a journeyman's cape, lanky, and every groat's worth will cost ye a threepenny bit. Leave it to me. I'll get old Omber to cut us a scutcheon for something less than a bishop's tithe.
Very well, but I will pay for it.
Nay, lad, 'twas not your doing. So, what did you say was the name of that brazen bit who chased ye out of Blanton House?
Miss Axelrood.
Ah, I knew it minded me of something.
You know anything about her? Piggott chuckled.
Nay, lanky, the name made me think. I need some tallow on these axles, or we'll be a-shrieking like an ox-cart, and I'll be loading thatch instead of quality folk.
Now, Piggott, I know you. What else?
What else could there be?
What about Miss Axelrood? The old man scratched his head.
A mere thought, like, about her, and you know, a lady, the Countess Duchess of Almost.
Miss Chudley.
Aye, now there's a woman as a natural gift for whoring. She was a great beauty at the start, but so were those poor silly Gunning sisters, them that married Hamilton and Coventry. D'ye know, 700 people waited up all night to see those two come out of an inn in the morning, yet there was nothing oorish about 'em. Then mayhap it ain't beauty, but gall, what you call brazenness. Well, that poor, mad Hannah Snell, what joined the army and was wounded at Pondicherry, and dug out her own bullet lest the surgeon find her out, she had more gall than anybody, but you can't rightly call her a whore. And ye might say the tenant lies in the ways and means, like. Nay, being that kind of a whore takes more gifts than Dr. Johnson, Dame Jezebel, and a gypsy juggler could trot out together. Like the way Lib, Magic King Fred of Prussia, him they call the Great, did she do it with her sparkling wit? She did not. Did she do it even by wagging her bottom? No, not her. All she did was drink to his health in fine, strong Rhenish, a full English quart of it at a gulp, and I, and another like it to wash it down. One, two, less than half a minute, so they say. One of her gifts. Part of the old gift of Oren.
He wagged his head reverently. Piggott, what the devil are you talking about? Miss Axelrood?
At the moment,
said Piggott with considerable dignity,
Oren and a gift. The gift.
He drove on in thoughtful silence for a time and then said,
I had a dog, a splendid spaniel bitch, who,
good God, man,
you're not hearing me out, lanky. She had a gift for rats. She could whip out rats where no rats were, snip, snap, snore 'em, and fill the air with flying dead rats. Bring 'em home, and she would stack 'em up like faggots in the ruddy dooryard. And proud, I had a tanner make me a hanger belt so wide of all the braided rat tails, 203 of 'em, approximate. I never wore it but the first time. She come at me like a fiend with a fistula when she saw it.
Piggott, what has this to do with—
Hush, laddie, Buck. As I was saying, it was a gift. The thing to remember about her and the rats, as with her ladyship, is that with both the pretty bitches, the gift come natural in all its parts. and it used to come to me often as I sat admiring her grace. That's the spaniel I'm talking about now. Her grace and skill, that if she'd had the company of some older rat hunter since she was weaned, why, her talents might have been cultivated instead of growing wild as they did. And wild they were splendid. What might they have been with a bit of tutoring?
That is ridiculous, Piggott. She caught more rats than you knew what to do with as it was.
So she did, and you've put your finger on the point about ratters. Good enough is good enough. But what must a whore be that she couldn't be better? What could she get that she was stopped from getting more? You see, if you consider it careful like, there's a difference, after all, between bitches and whores. Now take Lib Chadley for one. She's as an enviable freedom as far as it goes, but when you use your longest-handled muckrake, you'll understand she's boxed in. She's got a pretty spot indeed, but it's one she can't move from. She can't marry Kingston for being wed to Irvy. She can't divorce Irvy for fear of losing her share of him, in case he gets to be Earl of Bristol. What she should do is marry Kingston first, then dispatch her orgy. But that might smack a bigamy. Anyway, that's Chudley. And it's not her I'm discussing.
It isn't.
Aye, you been listening, Lanky? My, my, all I've said was she's boxed. And that shows she's as a limit and she's reached it. It occurred to me, as I'm sure it has to you, that if she'd had the proper hands to guide her in her youth, she might have done more and come farther.
A little late for sore regret, said Lance in his prim voice.
Aye, it is for her, but a woman like her has a pride in her accomplishments, as a fine barrister might have, or a horse trader, or one of them chaps that paints pictures. What might they do in the autumn of their life?
He orated with a showy gesture.
With their lives behind them, and all their great skills at a peak. Leastways for knowing how, even if they couldn't do it. Why, they would do what your friend and mentor Simon Barrowbridge did. They would indent an apprentice, that's what, and convey to the young all the wisdom of their ruddy, mucking years. That's what they would do.
Lulled by the rich, rough voice and its ready cadences, Lance was perhaps slow to absorb exactly what simple, single thing the old man was saying in these thousands of words. When it came to him, he stood up, and he shouted, "Piggott!" Immediately, a third-story casement banged open, and twice the voice of a crow screamed down,
"Stop your bloody squealing, you shining swine, and give a decent lady a wink of sleep!"
The decent lady followed her suggestion with a more substantial stream of hints with her slop-pots, which Piggott avoided by an adroit gigging of the horses, and they proceeded at a spine-shaking trot.
"Saving that up for a week, I bet,"
growled Piggott of their would-be donor.
"Oh, miser!"
He drew the horses in and gentled them, until at last Lance could be heard as he said,
"What you're saying is that Miss Axelrood is..."
"What I'm saying is this alone, Lanky. If Lib Chudley has apprenticed a girl, and if that apprentice has anything like the natural talent of a ruddy governess, and if that talented apprentice is your Miss Axelrood..."
"That's three ifs," said Lance good-humouredly.
"And if,"
Piggott rolled on ceaselessly as surf,
"you may have a fourth, Lanky, if this pretty little poignard of a girl has pointed herself your way, ye may call yourself but the bottom tread of a long flight of steps, to be tossed aside as if someone else wins the palm."
Lance threaded his way through the mangled metaphor and then laughed uneasily.
"All this, Piggott, because a lass ran out for a forgotten farewell?"
"Aye, all that, and also to take your tender thoughts away from the cobbles and the stinks."
"I'd rather the cobbles and the stinks," Lance mimicked. "Piggott, I do think you're quite mad."
"Aye, and so do I, lad, for not wanting you out of your depth. Here's your ruddy manor house, my lord."
"Well, take care my cloak doesn't go the way of the scutcheon,"
said Lance, as he stepped down, knowing that the old ruffian rightly read the annoyed affection in his tone. He could be quite sure of it, as Pickett swept off his varnished hat and bowed from the box.
"If the master has need of me, need only ring, I await his pleasure."
"If the master has need of you, he'll ruddy well walk down to the Purple Heart, hoping you're not too drunk to speak."
"Take care, laddie,"
rumbled Pigott, and whipped up his horses. Lance stood at the curb, watching him go, wanting to laugh, wanting to spit, wanting to make a gesture of some kind he wouldn't make if he could think of it. Then he took the old man's parting words at their explicit value, standing well back from the arch of the courtyard, looking for shadows, any blacker than they should be, any slight movement which did not belong. Over him the sign of the Dirty Beast creaked, but that was only a breath of wind. It had been the Doughty Lion before the Lord Protector changed the fashion. He stepped cautiously through the arch, and sidled to the right, and got his back to the wall. Footpaths usually operated out of their home districts, but sometimes the need was great, and in the dark. But tonight there was no one about. Lance crossed the courtyard, and tiredly mounted the outside staircase to the second story. At the top he paused again, but still heard nothing but the impatient thump of a dreaming horse in the stables below. Sighing with weariness, he went back to his room, taking from his waistcoat the great iron key. He unlocked the door, kneed it open, and kicked it closed behind him, and with the practiced motion of long habitation knocked down the bar. The pop and sputter of a stinking sulphur match caught him between breaths, and in the magnitude of his astonishment the small sound deafened him. The flame, when it came, gave him only itself and blindness. He saw it half die as it passed to a taper, and then a candle was lit. Seated at his table with his polished copper mirror propped against the wall, clad in a shift of fine sheer lawn, sat Miss Axelrude. She smiled into the mirror, a second flame in a copper world, and her eyes held his, and she began to comb her heavy hair.